Clash of the Titans in MotoGP. Closer than ever. Away we go. Brilliant start from Jack Miller. He's going to zoom through to the lead into turn one out front. Maverick looks like he's got away okay as well. Fabio will be third, but Miller leads into turn one.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 645. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
It's pretty good. I've been traveling for work, so I've been 4 days in a hotel now, and it's very interesting here at least in the States to travel again and then see how people are dealing with the coronavirus and what the rules are in this state versus this city versus that city. So I'm not here to talk about the virus. I want to really talk about racing. So let's just get to it. It was some good racing this weekend from Mazan on the second round.
Yeah, a lot of unexpected stuff. And, you know, that's one thing that I've noticed with these double headers is that I thought for sure what we're going to see is we see the first race and we would see maybe things were a little loose. And then the second race, everything would tighten up, but you would still see the same people up front because they're just going to carry their setup from one week into the next. So, but it really just hasn't been that way. I mean, there's a few guys that stay up to the front, but you get a pretty decent shuffle for going only a week separating at the same track. That's just bizarre.
Yeah, it is very strange that these races are so dissimilar. I really would never have thought that would happen, but it has, and it has been a spectacular racing season. These back-to-backs have been, in my mind, really, really cool.
It is. I mean, it'd be cool if they could implement something like in the future, like every year they do a rotating back-to-back, like one track gets to host it every year.
And so, that'd be awesome.
Just like there's a double dip every just one weekend. You don't have to make it a consistent thing, but that'd be kind of cool. Can you imagine back to backs at Phillip Island or some madness like that?
Oh, that would be insane.
Right?
That'd be so cool.
So, all right. So on this week's show, if you haven't already guessed, we're going to be talking about round eight. And let's try to bust out the Italian here, Jim. It's going to be the Gran Premio Tissot dell'Emilia Romagna e della Riviera di Rimini. Or for those that don't speak Italian like myself, that's Misano Grand Prix Round 2. Alrighty.
That's pretty good. I'm impressed.
You might be impressed, but there's probably someone who speaks Italian that was like, oh, man, that was bad. But, you know, we'll just act like I know what I'm doing and keep going on from there. I did see our numbers in Italy did go up, so I'll probably get some fan mail. Let me spell this out for you, bro. This is how you say it. That's how I got Pecco Bagnaia's right. His name got corrected by one of our writers. Says no, you gotta say it. The G, it isn't Bagnaia, it's Bagnaia. I was like, oh, right on, cool, thanks, bro. And so we always have those little helps. Little bit of rumor and news. We can jump in here real quick with. So now, interesting enough, Jim, Mark Marquez says he still trusts the MotoGP doctors, even though it's reported that he thinks they erroneously greenlit him to come back too soon after surgery on his broken arm. Now, that's interesting.
That's really interesting.
Yes, yeah, because and even Alberto Puig, who now is saying that as well, to no one's surprise that he's going to always try to sound like he always has the best decision, is saying the same thing. So this is kind of goes back to what we had spoke about this when this initially happened. He was trying to make this comeback is, you know, were these doctors saying, you know, were they not looking at the rider's best interests? I tend to look at this at both sides where, yes, from a standpoint of the show, they want to give the rider all the chances and they're not going to tell the rider no. And that's kind of where the problem is. There was no one thrown in the towel. But at the same time that Marquez is saying, oh, they greenlit me. Well, bro, you decided to come back too. And I know you're smart enough to know you broke your own arm. So, I mean, I kind of see like you could both sit on that scale of blame there.
Yeah, I think everybody's to blame. First of all, Marquez, he wanted to ride because he even said, I had to try just to prove to myself if I never tried, I would feel bad. Okay, well, then that means that you were a willing participant of this. Now, we've had that discussion about the doctors and whether they are thinking in the best interest of the rider or not. But I go back to this is sort of the leftover part of Dr. Costa where, hey, if you want to race, I'm going to do everything I can to help you to race. And it's not really look, you're hurt really bad. I really think you should not be riding a motorcycle kind of a thing. So there is equal blame to be had on both sides. That is for sure. I'm just going to think it's just going to be equal, and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Now, Jorge Lorenzo, a man who has spent a good amount of time being injured in his MotoGP career, he has now kind of reiterated or maybe even backtracked that he's going to be staying in retirement for the foreseeable future. Now, you know, take that with a grain of salt, because he said he's retiring, and then 3 months later he was signing a test contract and then with possibilities of some one-off rides here and there. So we'll see how it is. But because of the way this year, not allowing test riders to do any of the one-off races, he decided, oh, there's no point for me to jump in. I couldn't be up to speed and yada, yada. And even, you know, admitting as much as having Ducati approach him for getting back there and him kind of pulling him back, it wasn't because he didn't believe what he could. He still believes in his skill that he could compete at the top, but he says he lacks motivation. And I can totally understand that. I mean, you spend enough years doing this over and over, putting yourself online, and MotoGP and motorcycle racing doesn't just stop when you go get in your car and walk away from the track. In fact, the training in most times gets harder, because that's where the motivation has to come in. You got to get up every day. You got a really strict diet. You've got to get out and ride that, you know, ride your bike or go to the gym or do whatever it is. And it's constant. It's all day, every day. No weekends, because on your weekends, that's when all that work you've done during the week shows up for that you know, hour of work that you're trying to get that trophy at the end and get that signing bonus, right? Or that check. So he's kind of gotten away from it, and he's kind of saying, like, hey, you know what? Quality of life is kind of coming back to me, actually. Like, I've got my money. I can relax. I can eat whatever I want. Maybe I don't really want to race. Yeah, right? It's like, maybe I really, really don't want to race anymore, and maybe he will stay retired this time.
You know, I was never at these guys' level, but when I stopped racing club, I had a very hard time trying to figure out what to do. It just, there was something. I mean, this is on a go every weekend, every other weekend, go race a motorcycle, have some fun kind of thing. And there was a void, and it was really difficult just for me. I can't imagine being a world champion, be at the top of your game kind of a guy, and just suddenly just turn the switch off like that and say, I'm not doing this anymore. Because like you said, it's a 24/7, 365 gig for those guys. So I understand where Lorenzo was coming from, as far as like, hey, I'm going to take a testing role. I'm going to kind of, like, you know, wean the adrenaline rush off a little bit. But it doesn't surprise me that, having given this amount of time, that he's found out that there's other things in life too. And let's call it roughly a year for him. It took me probably roughly a year to really figure out what I was going to do. So I feel it. I understand it. And I wish him the best.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point with the void. There's a lot of pros in all kinds of sports. They do this. I mean, to reach the pro level, you've made a commitment, and it's all in or nothing. There's no such thing as anybody that backed into a professional sport at all. So when you've spent your whole life to obtain this goal, you obtain it, and you've done nothing but that. And then one day, it's all just like, okay, you walk out the door. You're not allowed back in the building anymore. Now it's like, well, what do I do now? I mean, it happens too when people go off to war and they come back. They've spent their whole life living a routine in the military, and they come home and there's, like, no routine. What do I do with my time? I don't know what to do with myself. So I think there was an interview with Mike Tyson not so long ago where he was just like, he was in tears because he could see, he's just like, he said, I'm not that person anymore. I can't be that guy I'd love to be. It's just not in me anymore. And I you know, what do I do with my life now? And that's got to be a big, you know, mental thing that no one really probably talks about so much for when these guys have to leave the sport, and why it takes guys so long to leave the sport. I mean, Rossi has nothing left to prove, but he's not going anywhere, right? He's still out there having fun, but there's probably a part of him that realizes that, hey, man, when I'm gone, like, I don't race anymore. And so it's got to be kind of a scary thing too sometimes.
Yeah, I think it would be. I mean, there's always that possibility. You've done something your whole life. This is what you love. Look, I work as a silly engineer, and at some point I'm going to retire because I won't have to work anymore. I don't want to work anymore. But what am I going to do with myself? And that's just a 9-to-5 job. It's not an adrenaline junkie thing. So, again, it's all things that we got to face at some point in time. But I think the biggest part of it is a lot of those guys never really stopped because they had to. You know, their bodies weren't telling them, hey, I got to quit because I'm tired of the broken bones or whatever. You know, injuries mount up and take their toll, and there are days that getting out of bed suck. And Lorenzo really didn't have that. He just, hey, I'm done.
I mean, just bad years, and then there was a little bit of getting beat up in his back, and it just, that was probably more of a pylon situation than anything. But enough about that. This is going into a sad conversation, Jim. We want to get back to the fun stuff with racing, because my goodness, there was a lot of good racing this weekend, and especially in Moto 3, which we're going to start with the qualifying now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in qualifying you want to go over? Because, I mean, this race is just tingling.
Just a couple of quick points I had. For me, in the first qualifying session, McPhee had just missed out of going on to Q2. Okay. That wasn't – there's so many that are so tight, not really a big deal. What was interesting and for me was that we had only two riders set a lap time halfway through qualifying one. And I thought about it for a little bit. I'm like, well, yeah, you're at Misano. Everybody knows where it is. But all the bravery was definitely on with Arbolino. He left it to where he had one shot to get through, and he did it. And aren't you impressed? Because he was the fastest of the four that went in. Then Arbolino, Toba, and Salak. McPhee got bumped, and so did Rodrigo out of that session, which was sad. But you know, McPhee was his own worst enemy, and they had a bent rim that was causing a vibration. So they had changed some of the setup to accommodate the vibration that was coming from that. So there were some issues that led to McPhee being bumped out, but that's what goes. The second qualifying session, they had Suzuki had a massive high side. He got a pole in his left wrist, and the question was it broken? Well, we found out later on that it was. And then it was all just chaos there when everybody came through with their last flying laps and whatnot. But if we want to look at who was actually on pole and how it lined up, Fernandez came through for another pole. That's his second one in a row. Then you had Arbolino, Minio, Reynes, Vietti, Finati, who looked pretty strong. Even Biaggi was commenting on that. And Toba, Suzuki, Masia, Alcoba, Faggia, and Agora. So that was qualifying.
Yeah, that's John McPhee's kind of had this issue this year, right? And it's probably what leads to some of his where he flirts with the very top of the championship, but it's kind of one of those things you look at, oh, you just change this here, change that there, and you'd be leading this thing. And, you know, qualifying hasn't been his strong suit this year for sure. He's had several times he's had to come back from 15 on back to get towards the front. And as we all know, early in a race, that can really get you caught up in some nasty stuff.
Mm-hmm. That is true. I think Arenas even made this point. You need to be on the first four rows of a Moto 3 race. That's not where McPhee was.
Mm-mm. No, I would say that's accurate, right? Those first four rows, because that gives you the guys that you're going to be around are typically the guys that are always at the front. They'll race a little cleaner. Tends to be a little more experience up there towards the front like that. And then plus, you're just a little bit more room on the track. When you're in the back, there's nothing left. So, all right.
You
so
know what's interesting? Mm-hmm. Arena said this, and I started thinking about what he said. And I'm like, you know, it's really true. You got to be on those first four rows, you can win a Moto 3 race. Then I thought about Moto 2. Well, Moto 2, you got to be in the first three rows to win a Moto 2 race.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a Moto 3 race, you got to be on the first two.
It's true.
So it kind of drops a row off each time as you go up. And if you think about it, that's really pretty accurate to how we see these races unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the further up you go, the rarer it is for someone to come from the back to get to the front, right?
Ooh, yes.
Mm-hmm. You're only going to see maybe one or two riders have the ability to do that in GP. I think Dovi's done that a few times, come from the back really well. Marquez, if he has a bad qualifying, he comes to the field. We know that's going to be. In Moto 2, there's definitely a handful of guys. But like you said, I mean, even qualifying up in the first couple of rows, if you mess up a couple corners and get bumped back a few spots, it's hard to make up ground. So, yeah, that's kind of interesting.
Very true.
All right, so that brings us to the Moto 3 race. Now, Tony Arbolino, we know this bike, this Honda, I don't know what they've done to the engine or the combination of exhaust intake to get the maximum amount of horsepower, but it shows every time because he's not the smallest guy out there on the bike either. But, dude, the whole shot that he got at the beginning is still, it's just amazing that that bike makes power.
Oh, he was late with the clutch.
Uh-huh.
He was late with the clutch. You can watch everybody else on the line move before he does, mm-hmm. and then the bike just accelerates and goes by everybody. Ugh. It's just, wow.
Yeah. They've got, and the thing is, too, right, that's impressive because that means there's power at the bottom and the top end of that bike.
Yep. So. Very, very much so.
So, We get a little up to the rear. So Fernandez, who did have the pole position, he makes his way back into the front quickly. And then Arenas this time was looking more like himself. He did not want to be sitting around laying in the back, but like ninth position. He was looking way more racy because the pressure's back on. The championship lead has been narrowed down and the people who are in the championship are in the front with him. And then about this time we're starting to look for, at least for me, I'm looking at the beginning of the race. Where is Binder? Binder's going to be coming through. We just know he is at some point. And sure enough, we kind of start to see him kind of come towards the front. We're asking, where's McPhee? McPhee didn't make his way towards the front so much, but right on lap 10, we lost Alonso Lopez. He crashed out. And then Arbolino, though, at this point of the race.
He crashed in the penalty loop, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Arbolino, yes, right, because he got the long lap penalty.
He got a long lap penalty. Mm-hmm. And he goes flying, charging into it, and just tucks the front. Splat. Oh,
yeah.
I'm like, you are no Zarco.
No.
Go see Johan. He'll tell you how you do it.
And then on this track, too, it's because they're so close to the ocean. They were saying a lot of, like, at night when the wind kicks up, it blows a bunch of dust out on the track that doesn't get used. So, yeah, not the best move. Oh, and we will be talking penalties at the end of the show for sure. So Arbolino, something was going on at this point with this bike. I'm not sure if it's him because he went all the way down to 13th. He fell like a stone. And then at this point, we lost Foggia. He went down on lap 11. He lost the front end. And Binder at this point has made his way up to 6th with 11 to go. And with 10 to go, the race has just been, it's hard to take notes because they've already been so tight in the battle swing going. But at 10 to go, that's why it's anybody's race. I still think they had a train of about 16 bikes that could just within that like 2 to 3 second range. It was insane. So this is when it started to get kind of lively because they have been kind of setting a little bit of like, all right, let's pace. And then everything went shop wimbo. And then things were getting heated up because Binder was making his moves. And he kind of had a bit of I wouldn't say a rough, but he left no room for Alcoba. And this is where Alcoba started to take his brain out. Because going down the back straight, he decided to weave and actually make contact with Binder on the straight, who almost made contact with Fanati. And that was his first of numerous like attempts of weaving on a straightaway, running it too deep and running out wide on these corners. I mean, this kid had a bad case of red mist. And I really hope that after this race direction took him out back and said, listen, settle down. This is, you're a teenager, we understand, you haven't really figured out that whole how to control your emotions thing just yet, everybody knows that, but this is your warning. You do it again, you're going to be sitting down for some time. Because that was some dangerous crap.
They need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am in no shape, I have zero tolerance, let me put it that way, for anybody weaving on a racetrack. I just do not like it. There's no roll cage around you or a tub crash cell, survivor cell around you. It is you on top of a motorcycle with a set of leathers, and you are weaving around for, in my mind, no reason. Okay, I get it if you're coming out of the corner, it's a long straightaway, you want to bend that straightaway and come back again. Yeah, but man, what Alcoba did was really naughty. I mean, he just decided to put an elbow on somebody and kind of move them out of the way on a 120 mile an hour straightaway. You want to put an elbow on somebody going into a corner or lean on somebody going out of a corner. If you've got a wheel in front, I'm totally okay with that. But this wasn't anything like that. And you're right. Race direction needs to set this kid down and say, enough is enough. You're not doing it again.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you got to control that soon, right? We don't need an incident where someone's like, you get these warnings and then they go out and do something like pull on someone's brake lever going down a straightaway. But
oh, you had to go there.
But hopefully, you know, like I said, he's a young kid, and hopefully they kind of go around and talk to him, and you know, some of the other riders may come up and talk to him like, look dude, that's not okay, like you can't do that. So at this point, Rodrigo and Viette, they were having a good battle. Rodrigo was having a really good race. He was making his way towards the front. He was up into second, and him and Viette had a bit of contact, and Rodrigo ended up dropping back to 11th, which was pretty much his race done deal. And there was a name which is funny. We just foreshadowed him a little bit, but there was a name making his way to the front looking good, and that's Fanati. Romano Fanati has been nowhere since sometime last season. I think, well, Sepang last season, I think he had a good race, and that's about it. And at this point in the race, now the gloves are really off. And Binder, right as he was getting to the thick of his, had a huge, huge high side. And this is his second one. And this one, man, I haven't been able to look it up or find, because he got up, walked away, which I was like, I don't know how he just got up, tough as nails. But then they show him a few seconds later, and he had the grimace, leathers open, and he was holding on to the turn marshal to get some weight, because he landed straight down on his hip on that outside. And that's a good way to crack a hip and to also, man, smash up the top of your femur into your hip. That could be some bad stuff that goes on right there.
Yeah, hopefully it's nothing serious except for some real battering and some real bruising. But it was one of those where, like, how in the world did you launch yourself this way this time? I just don't understand what he thinks. Or I really had high hopes for Binder in this race, because he didn't charge through the pack and be at the front within three laps. He, in my mind, started to work very methodically to the front, which is kind of how you really have to go about doing this. And you want to be there at the end, positioned properly with some tire left over, and he was looking good, and then it just disappeared in a heartbeat.
Right. And I mean, and this was, it was all on him. I mean, there was just...
Yeah, it was him. There was nobody, nothing... Nobody pushed him out wide. Nobody was there causing him to, you know, disrupt his line. It was all him and whatever throttle control he lacked or whatever it was.
It was a big old bummer is what it was.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But he got up and walked away, and hopefully we'll see him back here soon. Ayagura, who has really made his way into a championship contender this year, he had a perfect plan going at this point. He had been sitting around about ninth the whole time, and he started making his way right at the front just when he needed to. Arenas, seeing this and seeing that his champion contenders are up front, decided, you know what, I got to start pulling some moves. And going into that straightaway, right, or going to the long straightaway there, going to that tight turn, he ended up grabbing the brakes and dive bombing like three riders to somehow get in there. But Viette was having none of that. And as soon as they crossed back for the next corner, Viette ran him wide, kind of bumped him off and said, no, we're not going to play that, running in deep. And on the last lap, I couldn't even take notes. It was insane. I would say there was no less than 12 to 13 passes amongst the first four or five guys. I don't know where anybody was at any point. All I know is that when it got to the final corners, Viette got in hard, bumped into, what was it? Was it Ayagura he bumped into at that point, I think? They both ran a little wide.
Yeah, well, I thought him and Arenas kind of got bumped out, right?
Or maybe it was Arenas. Yeah. And that's when Fanati snuck on by the inside and held together to cross the line for his first win in quite some time. And that last lap. If you're going to watch anything from this race, just give yourself the last two laps and you will not be disappointed.
Not by any stretch of the imagination. It was a very much elbows out, let's get rough and ragged here at the end as it went down. It was all elbows every which way, and people were throwing them left, right, center. It was like a boxing match on two wheels. It was a fantastic race. But Fanati, with those weird lines, was able to be in a different place at a different time than anybody else was, which allowed him to sort of ride around everyone in some weird intergalactic time warp, if you will, that puts him in front. Because you just, Fanati riding the way that he rides was being blocked at every possible corner for most of the race, and then when everybody took their brain out and put their elbows out on the end of them, it just all of a sudden there was track space that Fanati was just magically in with the throttle wide open. And here's this guy you've been over a year, takes his 12th Moto 3 victory, which makes him the winningest Moto 3 rider, over breaking the tie he had with, I think, Juan Mir, if I'm not mistaken. But all credit to Fanati. I mean, he put it back together again. And I feel like we've been watching this and waiting for it to happen, because we've seen Fanati sort of improve improve. And he was just thinking it was going to be like a matter of time when he finally got one. I figured he would have gotten Bruneau just because of the width of that track and his weird lines would have maybe worked well there. But he won here, and all credit to him. He, you know, sometimes luck is just when preparation meets opportunity, and that's pretty much what he got. So no disrespect for Fanati, but it was a fantastic ride. I mean, it was really a great ride by everybody who was out there on the podium, to be honest.
That's right. So Romano Fanati, he brings it home in first. Celestino Viette got it there in second. Iacher in third, rounding out your podium. Albert Reyes brought it home for fourth. Joan Macia in fifth. Raul Fernandez in sixth. Dennis Anchu in seventh. Andre Migno in eighth. Katja Topa in ninth. John McPhee in tenth. Now, McPhee was up towards the front, was running close. Forgot to mention this, but got part of the bashing around in there, ended up getting spat out the back. So he was kind of sitting there with Iacher in that 9th-10th spot, but where Iacher made the right move about a lap earlier to kind of get by some of the riders, McPhee got caught up by, I think, some other riders' battles and had to take a step back. So he didn't get the finish that he wanted. Tony Arbolino was right there in 10th. Gabriel Rodrigo, he finished in 12th after having a very strong race towards the front. And the commenters, they kind of made a joke at his expense and ended up being true, is that you'll notice that Gabriel Rodrigo, when it comes to luck, he winds up on the bad side of it quite a lot. And it is true. He does run up at the front, and then somehow he is the guy that always is stuck out on the wrong side, on the outside of the turn at the wrong time. And it's kind of a bummer. It reminds me of what was it when Martin, before he was winning all the time in Moto 2, he was the bridesmaid forever. And it's like, is this guy ever going to get a win? And he kind of got the same thing where he was always in a position to win and something would happen right at the end. And of course, he had like Mir and Bender at the time in the series as well. But it's a bit of a bad luck. But, you know, Rodrigo, hopefully it'll come back to him at some point this year. And then just kind of finish out the top 15, you had Alcoba, Sasaki, Stefano Nepa there in 15th, which brings us to our championship. Now, championships is tight. We got to love it. Albert Arenas is on 119 points. Iacher is on 117 points. That's 2 points between them after 8 rounds. Woo! Okay, so can't call that to the end of the season. John McPhee on 98. He's, you know, that's a little bit back there, you know, looking at that 20-point range, but that's okay. You've seen how things have gone. Anything can happen at any point during Moto 3. So he's still, you know, kind of in it. Celestino Vettini, Viette, man, having a hard time with his name today. So he's got to talking about that Italian stuff and just getting all kind of out of
there
sorts.
You go. Tried to be all Italian and then look what's happened to you. It just fell apart.
That's right. Just absolutely fell apart. No beer again and just disaster.
That's the problem. Your problem. You don't have a beer.
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
That is. Tire issue. Next time you better have a beer. That's homework. Go find a beer next time.
I know. You know, I had some this week and I drank them all. I was supposed to save one, but they're just so good. Anyway, Viette there, 86 points. Suzuki, he's at 75 points, but his championship took a major hit because not only did he break his wrist, but he had a compound fracture. So it's probably going to take some time to heal because that's a nasty break that he had. And then Tony Arbolino.
My internal doctor source, if he's back by November, he's lucky.
Yeah. Well, even then, that's championship done for him, which is a bummer. He was having a good season, but have to go for it next year and round him up. And so that brings to Arbolino in sixth. Rodrigo, he's in seventh. John Macia in eighth. Raul Fernandez in ninth. And Romano Fanati, courtesy of that win, is now in 10th place. All right. Whew. All right, so that's Moto 2. So Moto 3.
Moto 3.
Yeah, we're getting on to Moto 2, which was another very interesting and good race, but almost has some very similarities to the race before it. But before we get to that race, we do have a bit of qualifying. And I would have to say, to be good in qualifying at this track, you needed to be on a Kalex.
Yeah, there is no question about that. It was definitely... You needed a Kalex to definitely win that race or to be anywhere near the front. I was looking for my qualifying notes here if I see if there's anything that I really want to run through on this one. But I think I got to give a shout out to Della Porta because he was on the come this time. Now I mean he's finally figured out what he's doing and is starting to make the bike work for him. Now, Della Porta is a wee lad. There's no question about that. He's not the biggest kid, and it's going to take him a little bit. He's a very Danny Pedrosa-esque. So it's going to take him a little bit to make this work for him, and he looked like he was really starting to get it figured out. But, you know, he was in the first session with DJ Antonio, Ramirez, Gartho, and Pacini was in to replace Jorge Martin, who is still absent due to the COVID rules and whatnot. But Della Porta, DGI, and Pacini and Gartho all make it through to the second session. Now, Remy was not riding because he still has the broken foot and the hand thing. So it wasn't there. But all kidding aside, Marini just absolutely threw down a record lap at a 135.2. It was amazing. He looked totally in control. He wasn't near the edge of the track anywhere. It wasn't like he was close. He was on the limit, but he wasn't over the limit. It was just a great, great, great lap by him. And then, you know, his teammate was right behind him. Lowe's, I thought, had a really good qualifying session as well. Kennett looked really good, too. And a lot of this, I think, had to do with the fact that Dunlap brought the softer rear tire. They brought a new rear tire that's a softer construction than what they've had previously. A lot of guys were using this sort of like how MotoGP uses a soft tire there in qualifying to get a good lap in. It wasn't necessarily maybe going to be a race tire, but it was definitely a tire to qualify on. But that's pretty much all I had for qualifying.
Yeah, I would say this is probably what Petronas Sprint has best qualifying as a team, taking third and seventh. I would think so.
Yeah. Chave looked really good in there until he wound up having that there. But for Petronas Sprint, they looked really good. It was good to see Vierge back up front, because we kind of made him like the lost man of Moto too there for a little bit. Like, hey, this guy had all everything in the world going for him and nothing's been right, and now he's kind of worked his way back up again. So that was really good.
Actually, you know what? This reminds me of something I just thought about today that I forgot to put in the notes. So I'm going to put a pin right here, Jim, because I want to talk about Petronas Sprinter Racing and something I thought about perhaps. Because we were bummed to find out that Darren Binder was going to hang out in Moto3 for another year. We're like, dang it, dude, why not make the jump? But look at the team he's on. There are a few teams that you can get into that have a straight line to MotoGP.
There's only two.
That's right. And he's on one of them
now.
Only
two teams.
So if he gets on that team, I mean, it's a natural progression for them just to move him up into Moto2. And then if you do well on the Moto2 team, guess where you can wind up? So maybe that's the long game here. His opportunities that came to him in Moto2 maybe were on teams that weren't really competitive. And so he looked at this and said, hey, you know what? If I get on this, I have a great stepping stone to move up through the ranks.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I also think that maybe the KTM doesn't suit him. And he's thinking that, you know, from what he's seen of the Hondas around him, that he would do better on that bike, which is entirely possible. The Honda is fast. I think the Honda, as far as their Moto3 bike, is definitely a little bit better on the front than the KTM. Because there's a couple guys who are riding KTM Moto3 bikes that they can't find the feel. So it might be the smart thing to do the whole way around. But you're right. It's a very, very natural progression. He's on a much better team. The team that's doing pretty well. And he's got a direct line to go all the way to the top class. So it's probably not the worst thing in the world that's going to happen to him.
Right. Keeping it right. So, all right. So we're going to pull that pin back out now, and we're going to go right back to Moto2. And why don't you kind of take us through the race, Joe?
All right. So the Moto2 race was a race of two parts. It started out, it was very cloudy. Suddenly the clouds had rolled in. There was talk of, hey, are we going to have rain? Will there be rain? You have to remember that Moto2 races are not flag-to-flag like MotoGP because of the one bike rule. So if it was going to rain, we were going to be stopped. But at the beginning, Vierge took off in the lead. He had Marini, Bezzecchi, and Baldessari behind him. Lowe's had a massive moment that almost ended in a high side, but he saved it to continue on. Somehow, Lowe's seems to save a lot of things that I can't figure out how he saves them. But, hey, if you can keep it on board, more power to you. Bezzecchi threw in a move and ran wide at turn one. He lost some major ground in that part of the race. Bastianini went through on Marini on a pass that was from way back. And he just braked into that corner and really didn't even use Marini as a berm. It was pretty damn impressive of a pass, I will tell you that. He had complete and total control of what was going on, which was nice. Roberts crashed with 22 laps left in there. I had such high hopes for Joe this weekend. He didn't have to come through Q1. He went directly to Q2. I thought, okay, maybe he's starting to find his rhythm here a little bit. However, he did crash. It was an insane high side that flipped him off. He had the back end come around. It was a little hard on the gas. And then it snapped back, and when it did, it propelled his legs off, and his legs went like over the right side of the bike, over the throttle, and it spun him around like 360 in a flat spin, and then plopped him directly onto the racetrack. He, I believe, just got the wind knocked out of him because that was an insane hit, because he hit pretty much like flat on his chest. You know, he didn't get a chance to sort of curl himself into that ball and protect himself. It was just, it was one of those things where, like, you're waiting. It was like, you ever hear that, like, that dull thud when something falls? That's what this was like. It was like that dull thump, and he just hit the ground. I was like, ooh, that hurts. And it did hurt. And fortunately, I haven't seen anything of the news lately, but I don't think he was injured other than just, you know, having the wind knocked out of him.
Yeah, I think that's what it was too. I think he just had that sudden shock, and he needed a minute. And when you're on the side of the track, you don't get a minute. You get on the stretcher. So, but I think that was definitely precautionary because he was moving around. But like you said, it was like doing a belly flop into the pool, but he did on the asphalt.
A belly smack in a pool. Yeah, that's definitely what it was. Yeah, it was like that. No, this is sort of where the drama kind of comes in, because now suddenly there's raindrops,
mm-hmm.
and so Vietti gets ganged up on, and Bastianini slides on into the lead right there, and then throws his hand up like, "Hey, whoa, stop the race. It's like, wait a minute. I don't think it's like you can't make that kind of a move and blow to the front and then just throw a hand up and be like, "Hey, it's raining. I want this race stopped."
It wasn't a lap later.
Like, what are you thinking?
It was literally, he passed him in the corner like, "Hey, let's stop the race." Dude, no. No, it doesn't work like that, boy. Because they're going to go back one lap. Chill out. Oh
yeah. Well, actually, we find out that the other thing that was interesting is this guy all kind of runs right together, because this is kind of like what happens in this moment is, you know, Bastianini's in the front. Suddenly, ooh, I got a hand up. Next thing you know, here comes DG Antonio. He's just flying through people. He's like cutting a swath. He's like a hot knife through butter. He's just suddenly blowing through everybody, which that speed up has a lot of front end grip. It was really good on the tires. He didn't care that it was raining or maybe was sprinkling. So he goes blowing through everybody. Then Nagami has a big moment. He rides off of the track. And then suddenly we're waving a red flag. Hey, we've got way, you know, this is too much water. And we get into a red flag situation. Now, during the red flag, Simon Crafar finds out that Bastianini wasn't saying stop the race. He was saying, "Oh, sorry for my bad coming through on you that way." Mm-hmm. Which, when you learn that part of the puzzle, it makes what Bastianini did not as, it still makes it funny, but
right.
He didn't mean about for the rain. He was like, "Hey, sorry, that was a little bit rough. I was a little aggressive, put my hand up, mea culpa kind of thing."
Which wasn't his first time in that race either. He had his hand up a couple of times.
It wasn't his first time in that race. It wouldn't be the last time he does that again.
That's right.
So we've red flagged the race, and we're going to wind up, you know, it's been decided, hey, we're going to have a 10-lap dash for the cash. All right, this is old school barroom fight. And everybody's like, you're thinking, who's got a new tire? Does anybody have one of those super soft tires left from qualifying?
Right.
Like, do you want to throw one of those on there because the track's cooled off? And then, you know, Simon Crafar says, no, I don't think you want to do that because the soft tire tends to tear and wear out, and when it's cooler, it needs to work when it's hotter, which seems sort of counterintuitive, but that's how they work. That's the weird part about racing, the black art magic of tires and understanding what they do and don't do.
Yeah, I had somebody from Pirelli explain it to me once, and I can't reiterate because I got lost halfway through the conversation.
Yeah, that happens sometimes when you talk to those tire nerds. It just goes. It suddenly you're hanging on, and then things turn into Charlie Brown's teacher's voice, and you're just like, okay. Yeah,
I asked. I'm cool. I said, can you explain cold tear? And that's the last thing I remember.
If you had a beer, you probably would have remembered more of it.
Or I had a few by that time, and that's why I don't remember it at all. We'll see. Yeah, there's a lot of times my drinking team had a racing problem, so you know.
Man, you know what, man? If anybody out there has, he was the guy in AMA who did Dunlop tires forever, Jim something.
Oh yeah,
I can't think of his last name
because it's been a minute since he's left the sport. He left during the DMG days, right?
Yeah, he left in the middle of, like, DMG, mm-hmm. And it's like, if anybody knows him or has contact with him, I'd love to have him on the show to talk about cold tear and how, because he's far enough removed from it that he's not going to give away any secrets, right?
Right.
So we could really get in depth. But aside, let's get back to the race here.
Yes, yes.
So it's a quick restart procedure for 10 laps. So in other words, you go out, get 60 seconds to get out of the pits. You got one mechanic on the grid. You come around, lights go out, you go racing. Well, they take off for the warm-up lap, and it starts raining again. So they delay the race again. So it's another, I don't know, what was it, another 10 minutes pass or something like that. And we were getting ready for this shootout. Well, we find out that, like, Vierge and some of the other guys are actually using the exact same tire that they ran in the race. They're not going with a new tire, not a new medium, not a new super soft. They're going with used rubber, which was, I thought was brave, but hey, better the devil you know than the devil that you don't, right? You know, I know this tire is working for me. I might as well take the gamble and go with it. So Bastianini, they start the race again. Bastianini and Marini do their same thing. He goes way deep on Marini. Then Vierge goes by at the start. I mean, it was just, you know, it became sort of like the Moto 3 Lite or something, if you want to think of it that way. And Bastianini then got to the front, and he just was clicking in the laps. He was in the rhythm. He was done. He was gone. Then it was like everybody was trying to figure out how to get around Vierge, because Vierge was sort of holding a few people up. Schrader was in there kind of holding people up. Navarro. Marini somehow was starting to go backwards. Bezzecchi was backwards too. Then Lowe's and Marini got into a real good little scrap there for a few laps. They would, you know, cut one underneath one, run wide. The other guy would have the corner because the track, you know, left, right. And they would just back and forth. Really, really good racing for those guys. We had five to go. Vietti runs wide, and Bezzecchi goes through. And, you know, Schrader and Vierge then tangle, and then Vierge goes down. The question is, is Schrader at fault in that one? What was your call on that one? Or are we going to save that for later?
No. This is, I've got it. I guess at the time I felt a certain way. I put Schrader hits Chavi and takes him out. So I guess that's how I felt about it when I was doing the notes. I haven't really had a chance to analyze this one. But I'm going to go with notes, Skyler. He was there watching the race, taking notes. So apparently he feels like it was Schrader's fault for sure.
I looked at it and thought about it, and it looked like, I have it in my notes, looks like he used Vierge as a berm. So I'm thinking, I'm going to go with you. It's Schrader's fault. Okay, so we're in agreement on that one.
Yep.
But then Bastianini was closing down on Bezzecchi and Lowe's because they all had super soft tires on. But it's like, well, okay, wait a minute. Are these guys really actually going to wind up getting by Bastianini? Because they reeled him in very quickly. Like, it was like there was a big gap, and then suddenly there was no gap. And I think at one point Lowe's was cutting like 7 or 8 tenths of a second laps faster than what Bastianini was doing, which, whoa, okay.
Yeah, ooh, yeah, when he got in the third, he was bringing it. Lowe's, had he had been sooner or gotten through just a tad bit sooner, his race was right there. He could have won that one for sure.
Yeah, I think Lowe's wanted to have five more laps. Mm-hmm. If he would have got it, you know, foreshadowing if the race would have ran straight through, maybe Lowe's would have really been in there. I know when he was in the pits, he was really mad saying, hey, it's not raining. It's not raining. Why are we stopping this?
It's not enough rain for a guy from Great Britain, that's for sure. He's like, well, yeah, this is nice summer weather. What are you talking about?
Yeah, spots of rain on windscreen, and a guy who races in Great Britain all of his life is probably like, ah, this is dry.
Right.
You know, guys that grew up in Spain are like, no, we're stopping this. But at last lap, it all held station. So Bastianini wins it, but only by about 7/10. Bezzecchi was second. Then Lowe's, then Marini, Schroeder, Dixon, who had a great weekend. He had great qualifying, had great race pace, was definitely said, hey, I got to learn, not willing to do anything stupid. But again, showing the strength of the Sprinter Petronas team. Then Navarro, 7th. DG Antonio, 8th. Luthi, Garthau, Liga, Corsi, Kennett, Della Porta scoring points, which is really good for him, and Manzi scoring that last point. And I have a spare thought for Pacini. He just missed out on getting a point on a bike. You know, he hadn't ridden in 10 months. He hops on a bike, and that's, tip of the Motopod hat to you, sir. That's pretty impressive to go through that.
I missed that guy.
It takes us onward. I do, too. And it really does. I mean, you're sitting there thinking like, yeah, this guy really should have gotten a little better justice. I mean, you know, all power to him. He didn't want to take a ride that he didn't want. And, you know, he did some commentating work and whatnot. And, hey, got ass back on a good bike and went for it. So we shall see what happens. But I think it's time to go over to the points and look at what all this craziness has endured. So Luca Marini leads the points on 125. Bastianini now with that win jumps up to second on 120, 5-point gap. Then Bezzecchi is there on 105 points. Lowe's is now the odd man out, basically with 83. Martin falls down to fifth because hasn't raced the last 2 weeks. He's given up 50 points. Then Nakashima, Virhe, Kennett, Luthi, Schroeder, Roberts, Remy Gardner, rounding things out there. So that was how Moto 2 went, and it's a pretty wild race there at the end. Again, it's another one of those gets a little sleepy, but you got to hang with them. And they come good at the end.
Yeah, there was a little, especially waiting for the red flags, doing the back-to-back. I think it was like a total of over half an hour of sitting around waiting for things to...
They lost some time, yeah.
Yeah, which made it interesting, but still, the end of that race was fantastic, but still a little bit different from the last one, but good to see. And that brought us into MotoGP qualifying. I did get to see Q2. I hadn't watched Q1. Know that we had Paul Spargo and I think Nakagami came through in
for the first one.
Correct.
Miller and Doby go through to Q2.
That's what. Okay. Yep. So I don't have my notes. So I was trying to go off the top of my head because I remember.
That's okay. That's why I have notes. It's all good. So.
But
it's all good. Because Zarco had fallen down. Rins was 7th in there. He couldn't put anything together. I mean,
what was Miller going on?
And Doby, with what?
With Rins, like what? I don't understand. This is where we're talking about seeing two different races, right? This is a guy who was battling for the podium last weekend and can't get out of Q2, and doesn't just barely miss it. I mean, he was nowhere.
Well, this is like last year when we had maybe a third of the season left and Rins couldn't qualify. Remember Aragon, where they gambled on putting him out on a hard tire because it was the only thing they could make work on the bike? Like, they subsequently just lost the plot. And it's like they've lost the plot this time, too.
It's so weird.
Mir couldn't qualify the bike that well either. Let's be honest, because he's not in Q2. Either. So the Suzukis were starting way back, but Mir's race pace is, well, foreshadowing, his race pace has been good the past weekend. So you're thinking his race pace is going to be good again this weekend. So it just, yeah, there's one of those things where it's I can't figure out what's actually happening kind of a thing, but there's something going on at Suzuki that we're just not sure about. But, you know, you gotta give him some credit. But if we get into Q2, Vinales went straight out and kicked off a 1:37. I mean, that was just like, or a 1:31.7. And that was like, whoa, that's like fast. Then Bagnaia comes up, and he's now fastest. And when we get through the end of the first round, you had Bagnaia, Vinales, Quartararo, Morbidelli, Binder, then Espargaro, Pol went, and that part of it. Now, Vinales was playing the two-bike game. He came in, he swapped, came back out, and he had put in another good lap and looked really good. Nakagami fell again at turn 15. That poor guy fell four or five times in the same corner that weekend. Just could not do it. So then Binder went to third. Bagnaia comes around with an incredibly killer lap to go to pole. Miller was second. Vinales was third. And then we have a question. Well, what happened to Bagnaia? Did he run afoul of track limits, or were they going to scrub that lap? Yeah, they did. Vinales came around and was second to Bagnaia, but pole would go to Vinales with then Miller, Quattro, Bagnaia, and then Binder. So that's how qualifying turns out.
Right. And so while you were doing that, I wanted to look at something because I thought about, we're doing this back-to-back with the tracks, right? And since we have Alex Rins to use as a time reference. So for when he qualified in the first round of Misano, he finished there in seventh. He ran a 132.090. And then when he qualified back in 17th, he ran a 132.275. So he had a 0.2 difference in his lap times. Worse, mind you, he actually got slower, which is what everybody else pretty much, that's the thing, they all got faster. So he pretty much maintained where everybody else picked up speed, and that's why he got shot at the back, because he didn't improve the bike.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Well played, sir.
So
very good.
That's because Jim has such a great detail there. I was able to kind of skim through that and jump around. I literally finished as you were finishing up your last few words, and I was like, woohoo, I made it. Cool.
We know each other way too well.
That's right. All right, perfect. So that brings us into a race of lots of things going on. So, of course, with Yamahas sitting up front, we're asking ourselves, can the Yamahas get off the line? Maverick has pole. Maverick always has had pole. But what does Maverick do? He slides back. Actually, me and Jim, it was capped as the Maverick muck-up last week, and he was going back. So here we go. We're starting the race. Miller gets a great hole shot. The Ducati is great off the line. But the Yamahas went right with him because this time Quartararo got off good, and so did Vinales. And then Vinales made a strong pass, which isn't his MO in the beginning of a race because, you know, we just talked about how he goes backwards. He makes the wrong kind of pass as people go by him. He got out front, and that's a warning shot to anyone. If Maverick feels good to go fast in the beginning, okay, that's probably a good sign for him. But we've seen that at Aragon where he shot out to the front quick and then slid back later in the race. So who knows? KTM was looking much racier this weekend. That was a team that probably did the most work between the both rounds because they weren't really racy at all in the first round from Misano. And now you had three of their bikes up front looking good. And that was a big, big difference. Actually, all four were up front for a short period of time.
yes.
Soon in the beginning, Aleix Espargaró, he crashed on lap one, and I don't know how Morbidelli stayed up. Morbidelli was in the back. He had a poor qualifying. The poor guy, after celebrating, ended up getting some kind of stomach virus. Must have had too much fun after the previous week. I don't know, but he just was not himself. And Aleix Espargaró low-sided and slid perfectly into the side of Morbidelli's bike, and Morbidelli didn't go down. I don't know how. He just kind of bounced off, ran wide, kept it up on two wheels. His mentor, who had a great race last weekend, also had a dismal race this weekend because he lost it on the front end in turn four on lap two. Now, at this point, Binder was making his way to the front. Binder was looking much racier, but he was also looking a little on the edge. And shortly
after,
he didn't look like, he looked like he was working the bike. He didn't look like he was flowing with the bike. He looked like he was like slamming the brakes, throwing it down. He kind of looked like the way Bagnaia rides that Ducati a little bit, where he's just on it, right? He's all over that bike. And at this point, he was getting up there. But we've seen Binder ride like this, and we know the KTM has to be ridden hard to get the most out of it. But fortunately, he lost the front end in turn 15, and it was like, okay, what's going on with the track here? Is it wet again? What's going on? Like, no, everything's okay. We just had a frantic start. And by this time, he had gone, and Bender went down a second time on lap four, so his race was pretty much, you know, done. Time's
yeah, it was
down.
Down there.
Yep.
See, that's what, to me, I'll disagree with you. I thought Bender was looking really good. I didn't think Bender was over the top. I didn't think he was out of control. I thought he was that Moto2 guy who had a bike. Like last year, a couple of those races he won over Alex Marquez where the bike wasn't really quite right, but he was riding around the problem to make it look good. I felt like he was there. I felt like he was in control, and then it just faded away from him, and down he went. Now, the second crash, yeah, he was just all over the place riding over the bike. He was fighting. He was struggling. I don't know if there was anything wrong with the bike or whatever, but he had the two. So I'll disagree with you on that part about Bender, but I'm a KTM fan, so take it with a grain of salt, people.
Bagnaia, he was looking great. He started to run down Vinales. He was looking very, very fast. And in fact, he ended up catching him and passing him and starting pulling away. And you're wondering, can Maverick fight back? Well, the answer was kind of not really. Maverick was able to maintain a gap of about that 1.3 to 1.7 range. And he held it a little tighter for a while, but Vinales eventually almost made the 2-second gap and was sitting out front. So, and this is kind of where I had in my notes here. I was like, doubleheaders. I was like, if not really giving you what you thought you would, because, you know, you would expect Alex Rins to be up there this time. You'd expect Walmir. Walmir was making his way to the front, but he had definitely not the greatest of qualifying, which you already mentioned. And at this point, Miller had already been dropping back through, and he ended up pulling into the pits with a bike issue. We later found out after the race that his bike had actually sucked in one of Fabio Quartararo's tear-offs from his visor. It was blocking one of the intakes, so he just lost a bunch of power on the bike. So, as Miller said, racing can be a cruel, cruel sport sometimes.
Yeah, that was on his, Miller tweeted that, put the picture of Quartararo's tear-off.
Yeah.
You know, go look for it on social media. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, I loved it by Jack. I wonder if we're going to start to see this idea of, well, you can't use a tear off in a race, because when I was racing Wira, you could not pull a tear off your helmet.
Same with AFM.
That rule, mm-hmm. Yeah, you cannot do it. There was like, they said, well, too many people have crashed on a tear off, and it's like I distinctly remember this. I remember the riders meeting Wira Cycle Jam, Indianapolis Raceway Park. Chris Ulrich was riding a 125 at the time. And he's up there. Who has ever crashed on a tear off? If you crash on a tear off, raise your. I mean, he was just riled up against this rule. He just thought it was the dumbest thing ever. But I mean, I've seen it happen in Formula One where they've gone into an engine, more likely into the brake ducts of the cars. I've seen that happen. This is the first time I've ever can think of it actually happening on a motorcycle. But then again, you have these wings on bikes now, which are designed to sculpt the air and force and create a low pressure area so that the bike grips the ground. Yeah, low pressure over the vortice of the wing. Yes, because that would give you downforce. And I think that maybe that attributed some to it. These aerodynamics tweaks that are there might have contributed some to that tear off heading into that intake. But I don't know if we're going to see any kind of a rule change or anything. I doubt it. I think Miller said it best. It was just cruel. Racing's cruel. But the guys worked hard, you know, and that's the luck of the draw.
I mean, it's the same thing like when a chain link fails, right? How often does that happen?
Sure.
Very little, but
they can. I mean, it's anything's possible.
Yep, that's right. All right, so after Miller pulled in, everything was kind of stationary. It's about 17 to go. Tito Rabat, he crashed at 15 to go. This is probably Rabat's last season in GP, I got to think.
Yeah.
Quartararo, he was starting to reel in Paul Espargaro now, and he was coming down because Paul was having a nice race. He actually had made the change the last minute. He decided, you know what? I've been on mediums all last race. I've been filling mediums. I'm going to go with softs because, you know, I got to do something. I obviously ran a medium. I didn't get anywhere. So he said, I'm going to run with the soft. And he knew. He knew. He said, like, I'm not going to make it to the end with a great tire, so I might as well have a little bit of fun. He actually said that later on after the race. It's like, okay, I can see that. Sure, let's go out there and have some fun. So because as they were starting to reel him in, because his tire was starting to chunk out on the left side, and then as we're watching Quartararo start to roll in, he was reeling in pole, and pole was kind of not too far from Vinales. Like, oh man, you look up in the corner of the screen, they've got Bagnaia, they got him on the back of the camera, and you're and oh, there's dust and dirt in Bagnaia's camera. It's like, oh, he just crashed out of the lead. It's like, dude, mm-hmm. There was 7 laps to go. You had a 2-second gap, and you go down. Oh, that poor guy.
Let me ask you this question. I have a question about this crash.
Mm-hmm.
So that crash was a left-hand turn that he crashed in, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And the leg he broke was his right leg, correct?
Ooh, good
I
question.
Believe it is, because he had a cane on in his right hand.
Yes, I do believe so.
Okay. Do you think that was a fatigue issue? Like, he couldn't push with his leg because his leg was sore and tired, so he couldn't push the bike back where he needed it to be?
That's tough to say.
You know, the weight distribution was wrong. I mean, granted, there is not a lot of evidence to support it, but I'm wondering. I'm questioning.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if the strength, because he finished the last race, and he finished strong. And we didn't see him fade.
He said he was tired, though. He said he was really tired. And yeah. His legs hurt.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. And maybe because back-to-back's there, right? It was even more tired this time. And then sometimes when you're riding around an injury, you tend to put your body in different positions. That's why, like, you know, if you have a bum hand, you say, oh, my back hurts. It's because your muscles are straining to hold up what your arm used to, kind of thing, right? So, yep. I mean, it's very possible. It's very weird, too. I mean, he could have just been off. It didn't look like he was offline.
No.
This may come down to, if you had access to data, it'd make a clearer story, you know, on the gas a bit sooner, on the brakes a little bit later.
That's another question. Do you think that we should be able to see some data traces as fans after a race has been run?
No.
Okay, good. Done. Because I'm the same boat. Yeah. There's part of me that says I want it, but there's part of me that says that I don't want it. But
I think,
you know, the engineer in me wants to see it, because I want to see the data trace, because I want to look at what happened, right? I want to know what happened to Ben Yahya in this crash.
Yeah.
So the engineer in me says, I want to see that data trace. The fan in me says, hell no, man. I don't want anybody to know what that bike has as far as data to, like, some other engineer and some other back figure how they were doing something, right? I mean, if you're going to do it, you're going to have to do it the hard way, like they did it when Honda figured out the Big Bang, and everybody was like, what the hell is all that? And they had to take oscilloscopes and record sound at the track to figure out the firing order was super close together. I'm like, that's how you figure out what your competition's
doing. What was it, the most recent with the clutch?
The seamless gearbox.
Seamless gearbox. There it is. Yeah, yeah. And everyone had to adapt
to
that.
Same idea.
Whole shot. Everyone adapt to that. You know, all wings. Everybody adapt to that. So it's always a game like that.
Yep.
So at this point now. It's good. It was. That's why we chat about stuff, or else we're just doing race reports, and we got to break it up with something. Quattroaro and Pol Espargaró had a good battle. The Yamaha is such a dog. Like, he just cannot get off the corner. Mm-hmm. It cannot run down the straightaway. It's just good for two things, getting on the brakes and getting into the corner. But getting out of it, nope. Straightaway, nope. And he could not attack Pol where he was weak, because he sat behind him in the corners, and then Pol just stand up on the fat part and just go. And then Juan Mir came up from the back and said, hey, Quattroaro, you know, let me show you how to pass somebody on this track. I got you. He got right by. As soon as he caught him, there was no time in between. He passes Quattroaro, and then boom, 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 he gets right on by Pol, and then Quattroaro's like, oh, well, I can do that. And then he finally gets past Pol Espargaró. We lost Iker Lekuona. He crashed out of 6th place or 7th place, I believe, with 2 to go. That's a bummer, because for someone who caught so much flack at the beginning of the season, he's really been on a nice ramp up with that KTM. And then we get to the end of the race. Vinales is long gone. We forgot to mention when Pecco was out, Vinales was sitting comfortable. He's leading. He's gone. It was really down to what Pol, Mir, and Quattroaro were going to do. Mir gapped him as soon as he got by both. Quattroaro gets by, and then they start to get a little of a dice going on, because Mir gets by, Quattroaro gets in there, and he's pushing, and gets to the end, and as they're coming across the line, it's, you know, we're thinking, okay, so it was Vinales, and then we had Mir, and then it was Quattroaro, right?
Correct,
not quite, because Quattroaro, who had some track limits warnings, ran wide in the last, not really wide, he just stayed on the curbs too long and got onto the green zone at the end of the lap, not more than 2 feet, and that was one warning too many, and because he didn't take the last, he didn't take the long lap penalty on his last lap, because this was before, so I got to back it up, this was the penultimate lap he did this when he was battling with Pol and Vinales, he didn't pull in, so they ended up deducting him 3 seconds at the end of the race, which put him back behind Pol Espargaró. Quattroaro was not happy. He parked the bike and was storming off. I don't know if he went to go storm off to his trailer to have a good cuss up, or if he was going to go look for some, you know, clarification from race direction. he seemed okay after the race and was joking about it, but, you know, he just do all that work to have that taken away. He said that after the race that he didn't see all of the warnings. He saw the first two, but not the next three. Take that with what you will. He's got to try to defend himself. I don't know if it's true or not. We weren't there. We didn't see the bike. But it does bring up a topic of discussion that I want to bring up with you, Jim, unless you have anything else. I'll go through the race results, and then we'll go on to that.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I don't have anything else to race. I mean, that was really good.
Okay, so perfect.
You covered it all.
All right. So, like I said, Matt Vinales, he gets his first win of the season. I think that's the sixth different winner now this year. So, it's anyone's game this year. Juan Mir there in second was looking really good on Suzuki. Now, he's definitely coming up in his way to the front. This is not just a one-off race. He's been very strong all this year.
Paul Espargaro got race of the day for me. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, he...
Great ride by him.
Again, qualified better, probably would have won this race. Third place, Paul Espargaro. Fourth place, Quartararo. Fifth place, Miguel Oliveira. Kind of like a quiet fifth place. You didn't really see a lot of him, but another top five from Miguel Oliveira and the Tech 3 squad. It's starting to look like a pattern now, which is great. We had Taka Nakagami in sixth. Alex Marquez with his... Hey, seventh place? Hey, not bad.
Well, he topped the timesheets in FP4.
That's right. I mean, I don't know what clicked this weekend, but hey, give it up to the guy. This is a guy who... I'm not going to lie. When he got the ride, I was like, cool, see you at the back. I mean, the bike is not great. And I think he's got way too much pressure to succeed, if you know what I mean. Like, he just can't be left alone to his own devices. Hey, Mark Marquez's little brother, what are you going to do? It's never, Alex, let's go do something. It's, what are you going to do to be like your brother? I can't imagine the mental block that he's got. Just if it wasn't his brother, he might even be better. I don't know. Dovi kind of hangs on to eighth, I guess. His quiet season with the Championship League continues.
Didn't he have a big patch on his leg that said unemployed?
Oh, he did. It was something about a bet. Like, he lost a bet or something. He had to put that on unemployed. I think it was a bet, like, away from the track with some of his buddies. Morbidelli rallying for a ninth place finish in front of Dani Petrucci, who's had a very somber year, I would say, his last year at Ducati. Johann Zarco kind of back there in 11th. Alex Rin bringing it home in 12th, and Bradley Smith in 13th. So,
I'm going to hit the points here real quick, and then we'll have the long talk.
Yeah. So that brings us to the championship. Woo! Jim, run us through this.
Dovizioso, 84 points. Quartararo, 83 points.
Okay.
Vinales, 83 points.
All right.
Mir, 80 points.
Whew.
You've got four riders separated by 4 points. Then you've got a drop-off to Morbidelli, who's on 64, who's tied with Miller at 64. And Nakagami's one behind at 63. So it's super tight. I think this is I can't remember the last time that we've had one, two, three different manufacturers in the top four with four guys going for the world championship. It's phenomenal. I really don't remember a time when there was that many guys going for the world championship at one time.
It had been before I start watching racing, that's for sure.
Yeah, it had been back in the 70s or something, because it not through the 80s, not through the 90s, and not up to now.
No, this is a very weird year.
Go open your can of worms up. Let's do this.
Okay, so this year, I feel like more than any, we've seen more races have been affected by track limits and limit warnings. And I'm not sure, out of my own history, I'm trying to think in my head, but these green zones that have appeared on these tracks, they have not always been there. But I can't remember when they've started this. And I don't mind them being on the outside of the curbs. But where I'm starting in, because we saw this happen in Brno, and we're seeing this now happen at this track, I'm not trying to take a bias toward a rider. I'm taking it towards racing and what's on the track and not on the track. I'm not a fan of these no limits at the end of a curb, at the end of a turn. If you want to have the rule where they can go out and use the curbs, then they should be allowed to finish the turn on the curb. If you are going to mark the end of the curb where the corner naturally ends up finishing as a no zone, you got to whip it back onto the track, then either that's where the curb ends or no curb at all. Because outside the curb, sure. Because the whole thing, you're trying to cut the advantage. But is it really an advantage to finish out the corner where the bike would naturally go as you're exiting the corner?
Okay. So to answer that question, I don't think if that's the natural progression of where you're lying and you're going to take that motorcycle, then I don't think that it should have been a penalty. Like Quartararo's part, I don't think should have been a penalty. Just like I don't think Jorge Martin necessarily should have been penalized for what happened in Austria. It's kind of the same thing, right? Martin was on a line that was just right there, and he nips that green paint at the end of the curb. So I agree with you in that point, but I think we have to look at what has happened that's causing this problem. There has been two things in my mind have caused this problem. One, there has been a shift in the Formula One world where we want to remove the idea of a gravel trap and put in this runoff area that's rough pavement. The idea being that, like, hey, I don't want to spend the time or put a yellow flag out or put a safety car out to recover a car that's stuck in a gravel trap. And because we only have 20 cars racing around in Formula One, if we have 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 of them that go off and are stuck in the gravel who can't get back on, then that's a bad show. That's not a good television show. So, okay, we're going to put these big acres of pavement out here. Okay, so now naturally any racer is going to try to carry as much corner speed as possible through that corner, carry it out there, and potentially run off a little bit. So we're racing at tracks that don't have gravel. And what has also happened during this time frame is you have created all the bikes have gotten so close to each other in time that the rider has to find every last little bit that he can possibly take to get to be faster. We're down to that little bit. So Quartararo, in an effort to try to be faster, has to ride that little bit harder on that little bit farther out of the edge of the curb, and he's getting caught by this little patch of green paint that probably really means nothing. And that's why we're here where we are. That's the how we got here. Now, what do we do about it? Now, I agree that you can't have somebody egregiously going over the curbs, running wide, a la what happens in Austria, right? The first turn there, people right off of that, they go 10 feet wide, 5 feet wide, and then roll over the hill. And you couldn't do that if there was gravel there. You couldn't do that if there was grass there. But the riders do it. Not so you have to call that. That's well out of bounds of what the track limit is. So I agree with it, like Australia. I agree with the ones at Brno. The ones in Spain, I'm okay with. This here at Misano was a little bit too far for me. I mean, they were really, really getting on everybody about riding out and finishing your line and carrying that momentum, because that's how Quartararo has to ride. He has to carry so much more corner speed and so much more momentum. He can't bend the bike over at that last little second because he's going to kill his drive onto the straightaway. And while I applaud the officials in, hey, this is the edge of the racetrack, you are not allowed to go over it, they have been very kind in the fact of saying, you can do it once, you can do it twice, you can do it three times, and you can do it a fourth time. And we're going to warn you the first time. And you're going to get, we'll give you the first one. Second one, you get a warning. Third one, you get a warning. Fourth one, you get a warning. At that, then you have to go to the long lap. So I'm okay with the warnings that are there because I think the riders need to respect the warning that's coming to them. And maybe Quartararo wasn't. Maybe he didn't see them. There was a lot of problems with transponders moving up and down the list this weekend.
The whole weekend. What a mess. The whole weekend.
So potentially maybe the information that needed to be sent to Quartararo's bike didn't actually make it to Quartararo's bike. We don't know the answer to that question, but that's a possibility. I mean, Quartararo could really be right about what he's saying. So long way round, I think you have to have a limit to the track. You can't have an egregious amount of running off, creating your own line outside of a turn. And if their rule is there, I think the rule should be applied fairly to everyone. So in that case, they are. I think we would not be arguing about this at all if there was gravel or grass just beyond that curb. So I think that's my long-winded take in the can of worms. Your turn.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said a lot of what I was going to say, right? It's circumstance. It's the way these tracks are built. I just really don't want to start down a path with rules that start affecting racing to where riders have to worry about more than they need to. It stops being about racing. It stops being about rules, right? It turns into strategy and you start looking more like F1. We're trying to keep things separate here. If the rules apply for everyone, you get warnings. Well, I guess it is what it is. It's just to make, you know, I just feel like you got to pick your spots, right? I can definitely understand, like you said, Austria was a great example because you can run wide and hit the gas early. It's no penalty to go out there because you ran it deep into the corner. You ran it wide, picked it up, and boop, you're gone. But in places where you have cutbacks, right, it's a right going into a left. Oh, you didn't make the right, so you just ran across the paint on the left and dropped right back behind the guy. If that was a gravel trap, your ass would have been stuck out there. So there's a reason that they have. But I feel that they need to reevaluate where they want to put these limits. And at the end of a turn onto a straightaway, if you've got three riders battling, I mean, can you imagine how bad this would look if these three guys were fighting for the lead and they all ran wide and they all took a 3-second penalty, so then fourth place gets the win? And then it's kind of like, well, that wasn't the win. You just screwed up the race because now everyone who was watching this had a great time and now it's a waste because – and the thing is, too, this is questionable again. And everyone was upset because, you know, Mir, he was on the green, too, at the end, right? But he didn't have as many track limits warnings, so he didn't get the penalty. So it's like – all right, at the last lap, when it's the thick of it, they all did it, but because one guy did it two laps before as well, his race is shot. And it's like, that's not racing. That's rules.
But racing is about rules, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the Wild West, but...
Right. Matt Oxley said, the rule book used to be like 50 to 80 pages back in the 90s. It's now double that size because that's the problem. That's the problem that we've been led into. And part of it's the tracks. And I see everything that you're saying, and I agree with everything that you're saying. But to me, if you want to stop it, then you have to rip up that pavement, and you have got to put something in there like gravel where the rider is going to have a problem. Something that's going to deter them from going fast.
Put some whoops in there.
Yeah. Well, think about it from this standpoint. We've been at Isle of Man for over 100 years. And Hickman set that incredible lap around the place, right? Okay, yeah, it was no rain the entire weekend. But they've also started to take the mountain. They cut down a bunch of trees so that you could see around corners, that you could be able to string things together. All those little things made it so that he could go faster. Because now they're not riding with a 1 foot to the edge of the road concept, and it's not 6 inches now. Now it's 2 inches. We're going to use all about 2 inches. That's what these guys in MotoGP are doing, the same thing, because the competition's so tight. So they're going to want to go there, but then it's behooving upon us to give them a track that's safe but yet allows close racing. So which way are you going to be? Because I can make an argument there should be a gravel trap. You could make the argument there really should be pavement there in case someone does go over the curbs. They're able to at least settle the bike without, you know, going off into the gravel trap. And can you imagine going in the gravel trap right there at like 90 miles an hour, just splat into the gravel? It's not going to be good. So there's some fine balance that we have to strike. And if anybody out there has any ideas, you know, email us. Motopod@motopodcast.com, because I want to hear what everybody's got to say about this, because I'm so in between on it that I can't distinctly tell you which way it should be or which way it shouldn't be. So it's gonna take a lot of talk and a lot of discussion. I just want to see where everybody is on it.
That's right. And don't forget, folks, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all of the hosts. Sometimes we'll all jump in there and answer. Sometimes it winds up on the show. Sometimes you get a little column A and a little column B. Or you can go to Facebook. That's facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. You can go on there and jump there, ask your questions, send us links, yada, yada. We're also on Twitter @motopod_pod. You can follow us there for news, announcements, and general motorcycle banter. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram @SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
I am MotoRGV at Instagram and Twitter.
All right. Now, before we go, Have you seen, okay. I'm sure you have, but I'm going to ask the question like I'm talking to everybody. Have you seen Long Way Round and Long Way Down?
Ironically, I have not.
Oh,
believe
man.
It or not, I have not. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. I don't know why I've never watched them. I just never have.
Well, you're in a hotel, so there you go. You got some homework. If you can find out.
I
think they're on Amazon.
I'll watch them.
It's a great series. For those of you that don't know what this is, it's Ewan McGregor and Charlie, I can't remember his name. It's his best buddy from back in the day. They get on adventure bikes, and in Long Way Round, they travel around the world, going all the way from Europe into Asia through Russia over the top into Canada, United States, and finally back to New York to enter the journey. In Long Way Down, they start their journey, I believe it's in London, and they go from Europe all the way down through Africa, all the way down to into South Africa. I think they make it down to Cape Town, I think is where they end up finishing up.
Yeah, Cape Horn.
So it's a great show. It's a series that they run. It's every like adventure motorcyclist dream. They go to all these wonderful places, these amazing views, and there's all kinds of drama that always plays along. The bikes break down. They have to fix it with zip ties and duct tape. Something happens, yada, yada. But the reason I bring this up is because a brand new one just dropped. So they did Long Way Round in 2004. They did Long Way Down in 2007. So it's been a while, but they just did. And it started a couple years ago. They started planning this 18. They shot it in 19. But they're doing Long Way Up. So Long Way Up, they're actually starting down at the city that's the lowest point in the world, I think, because it's even below Australia. In South America, at the end of Chile, they say the name. I'm going to butcher it. But anyway, it's a very small, snow-capped mountain city that they start at. And they're going to go from there. They're going to ride 13,000 miles up through South America, through Central America, all the way back up to Mexico, into the United States, and finish in L.A. It's going to be something like 100 days of adventure. It's insane. Now, previously, they've done this on B&Ws when they went out and rode like a true adventure bike. But this time, they wanted to offset their carbon footprint. So they've gone completely electric. And so for the trucks that they're using trucks that aren't even released to the public yet, the Rivian trucks. They're brand new, building them, I think, in Detroit, Michigan. So they built them, and they got the prototypes finished for them with like, well, this is spoilers, but they got them out there to them. But here's the cool part. This year, they're doing it on electric bikes, but it's not who you think it's going to be. It's Harley Davidson's new electric bike
that thing?
Harley Davidson went and converted them into adventure bikes for this trip. It is cool as hell. And there's reasons why they could do electric, but I don't want to spoil much of the show because it's only 3 episodes in and another one comes out Friday, but it's on Apple Plus. And that's kind of where it's like, oh man, because not a lot of people have that. Apple Plus is Apple's streaming service. If you've bought an Apple device within, I think, the last year, you get a free year of it. If not, you got to sign up for it. I know, another streaming service. But if you're a fan of Long Way Down and Long Way Around, you got something to look forward to.
Sounds cool. I got Apple Plus, so I'll have to watch the first two, and then I'll watch the series.
Now you don't have to ask what you get to watch besides racing. You're good to go. See, you're all set.
Exactly. It's all perfect. My wife's going to love me that much more.
All right. Speaking of wives, I need to get out of here. I said I was supposed to go walking. I think the sun has pretty much gone down. I may have ruined that. So, Jim, it's an hour and 23 minutes. I got to get the hell out of here. It was great talking with you, and I will catch you at the next race. I'm not even sure when that is.
Yeah, I think we're going to Barcelona next week.
All right, cool. I'll catch you after Barcelona next week. Take it easy.
All right, later.
Zoom, zoom.